All rise. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 060369, In re. Jack Jordan, M.D., an original proceeding. Docket number 060574, 20801, Inc. versus John L. Parker from Harris County in the 14th Court of Appeals District. And docket number 060952, In re. Eduardo Gracia Bazan, which is also an original proceeding. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these arguments, and the court will take a brief recess between the arguments. We expect to complete all of them well before noon. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 060369, In re. Jack Jordan, M.D.
May it please the court, Mr. Cooper will present argument for the relator. Relator reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
The court. The issue in this case is a narrow one, and that is whether the stay on discovery in Chapter 74.351S, imposed until an expert report is filed, applies to discovery under Rule 202. There are two statutes that I believe are important to the court's consideration of this matter. The first is Chapter 74.351S, which is in tab 1 of the handout that we provided to the court yesterday. The operative and key language in Section 74.351S is as follows. Until a claimant has served the expert report and curriculum vitae as required by subsection A, all discovery in a health care liability claim is stayed. There are three exceptions that are not applicable here, but that is the operative language. All discovery in a health care liability claim is stayed until an expert report is filed. Now, the second statute that we believe is very important to this court's consideration is Chapter 74.002. And essentially what it says is, to the extent there is any conflict between Chapter 74 and any rule of civil procedure, rule of evidence, or other rule of court, the provisions of Chapter 74 will control over the rule of evidence, rule of civil procedure, or rule of court.
How about Rule 13? I mean, what if you had a situation where someone simply could not tell? And there may be disputes in this case as to whether you've reached that point or not, but obviously the courts of appeals are split because of the obvious unfairness if you had a situation where someone could not prove their claim without taking a pre-suit deposition.
Well, I think there's a couple of avenues that are available, Your Honor. First, Rule 202, which is the rule in Texas that addresses pre-suit discovery, provides for two forms of discovery. Rule 202, which I believe is tab number 5 in our handout, if you look at 202.1, it provides for oral depositions. It also provides for written depositions. If you look then at 74.351S, it allows actually written depositions to be taken prior to the filing of an expert report.
But you have to file suit first, and you can't file suit first unless you can comply with Rule 13.
Well, I believe you can go ahead and take pre-suit written depositions under Rule 202 to get the information which a plaintiff might need. Because, and I think that would be one way to harmonize 74 3.351S, which allows written depositions before the expert report, and Rule 202.1, which allows both written depositions and oral depositions.
Have you seen written discovery in a case that hadn't been filed yet?
I'm not talking about written discovery, Your Honor. I'm talking about written depositions.
That's what I'm talking about.
Well, actually, if you look under Rule 202, which allows for written depositions to be taken, a court reporter would be contacted. There would be the written questions attached to the subpoena who would be served upon the deponent, which is the way that typically depositions upon written questions are taken ordinarily under Rule 200.
Of course, 202 allows you to take oral depositions, too.
It does. But you have a prohibition, I believe, in Rule or Chapter 174.351S on the taking of oral depositions. Now, the second part, Your Honor, regarding if there is some problem with the medical records. And of course, the plaintiff is able to get their medical records.
So you would expand in 351S to depositions or written questions under 200 to also include 202?
Which provide for written depositions. I think that is a fair harmonization of those two, the Rule of Civil Procedure as well as Chapter 74.351S.
What about the issue that Rule 202 is not a health care liability claim? It's a potential claim. It's investigating. It doesn't even come under Chapter 74.
Sure. Okay. The Court of Appeals, and I think that was the primary focus that the Court of Appeals addressed. And what the Court of Appeals said was there was a distinction between a potential cause of action versus a cause of action. And if you look at their opinion, they made the following statement. Consequently, a potential cause of action is a cause of action as that term is defined at common law. And the court concluded that, therefore, the plain language of 74.351S does not support a conclusion that the legislature intended to characterize a potential cause of action as a health care liability claim. Well, with all due respect to the 12th Court of Appeals, if a potential cause of action is a cause of action, then it is a health care liability claim. If you look at tab 3 of our handout, it defines a claim. Section 74.351R2 defines a claim as a health care liability claim. Then if you go to tab 4, the definition of health care liability claim is contained at 74.001A13, which defines a health care liability claim as a cause of action. So, if a potential cause of action is a cause of action, as the Court of Appeals held, then it is a health care liability claim, and it is subject to the prohibitions contained in 74.351S.
Paragraph U. If I didn't know anything else about the statute, and I just had U in front of me, paragraph U.
Sure.
I would think that I would be entitled to take two depositions no matter what. It says, may take not more than two depositions. If it said, may not take more, I would think, well, maybe there's something else in this statute that impacts on this. But when it says may take not more, that kind of sounds like you have the right to do that. And you say that this has to be harmonized with S, and of course we want to do that if we need to, but it starts out notwithstanding any other section. So you might say notwithstanding S, party may take not more than two depositions for the export reporters served. What that kind of reads like you have the absolute right to take two depositions.
Well, again, I think in construing the statute, the court is required to attempt to give effect to each and every provision of the statute under the Code Construction Act.
Unless one says, don't worry about the rest of it, which this one sort of says.
Well, except though you have provisions in subsection S, which talks about discovery being stayed except for the three forms of discovery that are listed in 1, 2, and 3. There have been two cases, and I'm sure the court is aware, that have addressed the application of U and S, the N. Ray Miller case out of Beaumont and the N. Ray, and I'm going to mispronounce it, H-U-A-G-Hog, or Hogg case out of Houston, and both of them said that when you read those two provisions together, that the depositions that are referred to in you refer to the depositions that are allowed under subsection S. And essentially they said they would be part depositions of non-parties. Otherwise, the legislative intent of the statute would be defeated. Now, going on, this court, as far as the cause of action...
How do we know that? Why would the legislative intent be defeated?
Well, one of the if you look at the legislative history, and we have it quoted in our briefs, the whole purpose of the expert report requirement was to prevent extensive discovery from being taken.
It was to prevent plaintiff from just suing everybody that's on the chart, which is what went on.
Well, I believe it was also to prevent a lot of discovery being taken before there was this determination that there was a bona fide case to proceed. Because I think some of the, with due respect, Your Honor, some of the testimony that came out during the hearings for House Bill 4 were that I believe some 80% of health care liability claims were dismissed with no indemnity, yet there was a lot of attorney's fees and expenses associated with those claims.
So you think it's important for us to consider legislative history in this case?
Legislative history is one issue that can be considered if it is instructive on the intent of the legislature.
And then in considering legislative history, what are we to make of the fact that there was a lot of discussion on Rule 202, it's in and it's out, and there's testimony that the legislature considered, and in the end it seems like they sort of threw up their hands and said we're not sure about this. And you couple that with the fact that one of the purposes of the 74 was to prevent frivolous lawsuits from being filed. So what do we take, you know, if you look at both of those, it would support, arguably, the proposition that pre-suit depositions can be taken.
Well, two things if I could address. The first issue is the legislative history itself. And there was an extensive revision of the bills, particularly those involving Rule 202. The Court of Appeals, the 12th Court of Appeals, gave particular weight to some of the testimony of the witnesses who testified for the bills, which we believe this Court's prior decision says the testimony of the witnesses really isn't indicative of what the legislatures themselves thought or intended when they passed the bill. The Eastland Court of Appeals, in the N. Ray Raja case, which is currently before this Court, said... The legislative history is somewhat confusing and is not instructive because what the legislative history can be read either way. For example, the legislature could have said the reason we don't need the prohibition on Rule 202 is because we have 74.351S, which says all discovery in a health care liability claim is stayed. And a health care liability claim means a cause of action. So all discovery is stayed and we don't need the prohibition. Then you can also make the argument that Mr. Libby is making is, well, there is some intent by leaving it out that, you know, perhaps it was to be there. The Eastland Court said it is confusing, we don't think, that it's particularly instructive and did not give great weight. But they said this. They said that it's ironic and it's hard to believe that the legislature would attempt to limit discovery after a lawsuit has been filed in order to try to address the medical malpractice crisis, but they're not going to limit discovery at all before the lawsuit is filed.
Well, but what if you don't know? I mean, we've seen some cases up here where it's pretty close, at least I think so, about whether it's a health care liability claim or not. Okay. And so wouldn't, with all the discretion that's given to a trial court under Rule 202, the preliminary requirements to be met in order to get this type of discovery, why wouldn't that be permitted?
Okay, two things, Your Honor. First is, I think if there is a question, you've got the medical records, which the plaintiff's entitled to. If there is a question, I believe they're entitled to the Rule 202 written deposition. But second, the N. Ray Raja court said that if the medical records are sparse, if they are incomplete, that is one of the factors that the trial court should take into consideration in determining whether or not the report represents an objective good faith effort to file the report. So if there is not much information, the medical records do have gaps in them, that is one of the factors that the trial court should take into consideration and should put in the order that affects the determination whether or not the report represents an objective, good faith effort to comply with the report requirements as set forth in R6 of Chapter
74. So you would say that if somebody comes to a trial court with a petition for a Rule 202 seeking this type of discovery, you have to have some sort of a preliminary determination as to whether it falls within a health care claim or not?
Well, there, obviously, to determine whether or not Chapter 74 would be applicable, there would have to be a determination that it was a health care liability claim.
So you say yes.
Yes. Obviously, in this case, there was no question because it was only doctors and hospitals that were sued or that were named as potential parties in the Rule 202 petition.
You would say sue everybody in the records. If you can't tell what happened, sue everybody in the records, then get the discovery that's allowed.
I'm not saying that at all, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that you've got the medical records. I'm saying you can take written depositions under Rule 202. And then if there is some question later on and you decide to file a lawsuit against someone, and the question is whether or not your report is an objective, good faith basis or attempt at the expert report, you have that available to you as well in order to get past the expert report requirement. That, to me, is an harmonization of Rule 202 with Chapter 74.
Okay, there are many protections since HB 4 for doctors and people in the medical field services. What's the harm in allowing a couple of depositions under this rule? I don't see a harm there, especially when it's not substantially clear in my mind whether or not these depositions can be taken or not.
Well, again, the harm is the legislature, I think, clearly expressed an intent under Chapter 74.351S for most all discovery.
They didn't clearly address this 202, as Chief Justice Jefferson said. It was talked about, then left out.
Well, with all due respect, I think when you look at the definition of a health care liability claim, which is a cause of action, and when it says all discovery with respect to a cause of action is stayed, I would argue on the clear language of the statute, the legislature has fairly clearly expressed their intent.
Any further questions?
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument now from the real party in interest.
Mr. Libby will present argument for the real party in interest.
May it please the court. The question today is not whether a plaintiff who contemplates a health care liability claim can avoid the limitations of discovery under 74.351S by asking for pre-suit depositions under 202. The real issue in this case is whether this court will bestow a gift upon these parties that was requested of the legislature in 2003 but was not bestowed upon them. At stake in this case is whether our civil justice system will support the notion that justice is predicated upon the discovery of truth, or whether wrongdoers may escape justice by hiding facts. Yes, ma'am.
On page one of, I guess this is the relator's brief, they list some of the questions that you want in the deposition, and those are what guidelines, protocols, et cetera, the hospital has. Were they followed? Why can't these same inquiries be made on a deposition on written questions?
We could get some of those under deposition or written question if 202 were allowable under 74.351. But more importantly, the things that we don't know in this case is that we know that Nancy Allen should have had a stress test either before discharge or within 3 days. We know that CVC was contacted, but that never occurred. She died before that was done. And we know what the standard of care is. The standard of care is an EKG stress test within 3 days. That was not done. Now, did Dr. Jordan, when he scheduled the CVC, did he tell CVC it had to be done in 3 days? If he did, then Jordan is not going to be a party to this potential claim ever at all. Did CVC ignore that? Did Dr. Jordan fail to inform them? And those are things I can't really get with a deposition on written questions.
Or how about interrogatories?
I don't think that Rule 202 allows me to do interrogatories, Your Honor.
Well, the subsection S does.
It's an interesting argument that Mr. Cooper made. He said, on the one hand, Chapter 74 prohibits Rule 202 depositions. But on the other hand, he says, but you can do 202 depositions, but you can't do oral depositions. I think that that is an extremely inconsistent application. The reality is, as was pointed out, that the trial judge has discretion to limit the number of depositions and the scope of the depositions and the questions that can be asked.
I guess the question is, how would you be harmed if we were to harmonize these two provisions, the rule and the statute, and the way Mr. Cooper suggests, and say, yes, you may not know whether you have a claim or not, but you can arrive at an answer through these sort of written questions or interrogatories. And if that satisfies the purpose of preventing you from filing a frivolous lawsuit, then why shouldn't that be the way we resolve the case?
Well, the harm would come in two different ways. Number one, written discovery is not the same as oral deposition.
But 202 depositions aren't the same as a lawsuit either. I mean, the purpose is just to give enough information to the plaintiff to decide whether or not they have a claim. It's not intended to be wide-ranging and full in scope like after lawsuit depositions.
I think that we would necessarily have to read into the statute and make additions to the statute beyond the legislative intent to allow any type of pre-suit discovery within the context of Chapter 74. But the more disturbing thing to me personally is the idea that if we had to perpetuate the testimony of a dying cancer victim, we would have to do that by written question. And clearly that would not serve justice in any form or fashion.
Counsel.
Yes, sir.
Counsel, that may be so. Our primary task here today is not to do what we think serves justice. Our primary task is to do what the legislature said.
Yes.
There's been a lot of discussion about intent. You know, one well-known jurist, Felix Frankfurter, wrote, when counsel talked about the intention of a legislature, I was indiscreet enough to say I don't care what their intention was. I only want to know what the words mean. Part of the discussion today highlights how confusing legislative history can be and inconclusive. Why don't we just look at 351S and say it only allows those three types of discovery here, and there's no need to harmonize with 202 because the legislature passed a statute and says this is the law. We're not about justice here today,
right.
Narrowly speaking. We're about what did the legislature say we should do.
Importantly, Chapter 74 only applies after a health care liability claim letter is sent, and after and 7351S applies only after a lawsuit is filed.
You make that argument, and then the other side points out that Chapter 74 uses the term health care liability claim at least twice to refer to claims that are not filed.
I would submit.
So I don't think you can say that categorically, not in Chapter 74.
Chapter 74 applies to health care liability claims and causes of action. Rule 202 is not a health care liability claim, and it is not a cause of action. And in that way, Justice...
It's not a walk in the park.
Pardon?
It's not a walk in the park. The reason we have lawyers and subpoenas and stuff there is because somebody thinks they've got a potential claim or cause of action.
Yes, we believe we may have one.
The cause of action is always is there, whether it's potential or whether you recognize it or not. I mean, if a plaintiff has a cause of action, never knows it, and statute of limitations run, that doesn't mean there wasn't a cause of action.
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor, you're absolutely correct.
So why is this limited to after it's filed?
Because although a cause of action may exist for Dr. Allen in the death of his mother, he doesn't have enough facts to know whether a cause of action exists in the first place. And if it does exist and he can't find out if it exists, I cannot file his case for him.
I agree with you. That, you know, it sounds like there's certainly going to be cases where you can't tell. Mm-hmm. And if the statute says you can't find out, you're going to be in between a rock and a hard place. But, you know, nobody's asking us to declare this unconstitutional as a result. It's disputed whether that's true here. So,
did you ask the trial court for any of the three types of discovery under 351S?
I did not.
So, if you had asked and the trial court would have ordered it, then you may be getting the information you think you need, but you haven't asked.
And I did not ask because Chapter 74 has never been invoked in this case. No suit has been filed. We never filed a health care liability claim letter. So we can't proceed under Chapter 74 because Chapter 74 has never been invoked.
Okay. We'll have to look at this more clearly, but 74.051A says that there needs to be written notice of a health care liability claim, mm-hmm. and it uses that term in quotes and specifically in the statute. That notice has to be given at least 60 days before filing suit. So Chapter 74 uses health care liability claim there to refer to a potential claim. You have to give notice of it 60 days before filing suit. And there's at least one other place where Chapter 74 suggests that a health care liability claim does not have to be a lawsuit. So I understand that's your argument, that it does have to be, but Chapter 74 has examples that run counter to that argument.
If I may, Section 74.051 does not say you have to give notice of a potential health care liability claim. It says you must give notice of a health care liability claim. At this stage of the game.
That's what I said. But by saying you have to give notice of that claim at least 60 days before filing suit,
yes.
that means you have to give notice of a claim before it is filed.
Exactly.
Which is the argument, at least from petitioner, of what we have here. You believe you have a claim, you don't know who to sue, mm-hmm. and you're trying to get discovery to find out who to sue.
We have not, first off, given a notice of health care liability claim because, quite honestly, I don't know if this is a health care liability claim that has merit or not. I don't know the circumstances around the events, and I don't know who is responsible, if anybody. At the end of the day, if I'm allowed this discovery, there's a real chance that nobody will ever get sued because there's a real chance there may not be a health care liability
and
claim.
On that subject, if you can't take this discovery, you're not going to file a claim? Is that
I
true?
Can't, Your Honor, not in good conscience and not in compliance with Rule 13.
Okay.
What would, if you think under Rule 13 there's a reasonable basis for filing a claim, you would still have 120 days and could still take this deposition after it was filed and then file a report. What would keep you from doing that?
Well, with the limited nature of written discovery and finding out information, the problem is going to be I may or may not get information that will allow me to prepare a dispositive expert report. But before I can get to that point, I have to sign a pleading that says this is a health care liability claim that has basis in fact, and Your Honor, I cannot in good conscience do that.
But before we sanction you, as Park pointed out with opposing counsel, one of the things we take into effect is how much could you find out? If the answer is you couldn't find out from the records, you're not supposed to be sanctioned, are you?
Well, I think I get sanctioned if I file a case that says somebody breached the standard of care, and I don't know that they did.
It says, to the best of their knowledge, information, and belief formed after reasonable inquiry. And you don't think it's a reasonable inquiry if you ask all the questions you can?
I believe it is a reasonable inquiry if I can ask all the questions I can, but I think the time to do that is before I send a claim.
And the troublesome part of that,
sure.
is... wouldn't it behoove every plaintiff in every case to take all their discovery before filing suit?
Absolutely.
The question is, doesn't this exception swallow the rule?
It does not, Your Honor.
How does it not?
I have been representing plaintiffs in medical malpractice cases in this state for 20 years. This is the very first time I have ever filed a petition for Rule 202 depositions because most of the time the record can reveal and does reveal who breached the standard of care and the causal relationship.
That's fine, but if we now say you can take all the discovery you want, you just have to do it before you file suit because after you file suit, you can't take any more discovery until an expert report is filed.
We have to remember, though, that simply because I file a 202 petition doesn't mean I get to automatically take depositions. There's a gatekeeper there. And I think, quite frankly, the Texas legislature, and especially the Senate, recognize the gatekeeper function there. That trial judge has to be convinced, first off, that we qualify under Rule 202, and it's going to be in the interest of justice, and it will preserve justice, et cetera. And if I convince him at that point, the trial judge can limit me to the number, to the scope, and the amount of time.
But if you were a plaintiff and you knew that the rule was, whether it made any sense or not, that you could take unlimited discovery before you file suit, But after you file suit, you're limited to paragraph S. Wouldn't you take more discovery, or at least try to take more discovery, before suit was filed?
If I needed information and facts to be able to comply with Rule 13 and give my expert enough facts to write a dispositive report, yes, Your Honor, I would seek discovery.
I've got a question or two about your interpreting legislative history. You've talked about how it can be hard to decipher. As I understand it, in the legislature, in the bill form, there was a provision that said no 202 pre-suit depositions with health care liability claims. And then that provision ended up not being in the final statute.
Yes.
So the argument seems to be that a negative pronouncement in a statute, a bill that ends up not being in the statute, suggests the opposite of the negative pronouncement. That is, because this provision that said you can't get pre-suit depositions was taken out, and that suggests that you can take pre-suit depositions, especially with, as you would argue, Rule 202 on the books. That seems kind of curious to me, because let's take another example. What if the legislature had a bill in front of it that said taxes shall not rise by 10%, and that did not make it in the final statute? Does that mean that taxes shall rise by 10%?
I don't know about tax law, Your Honor.
But the fact that a negative pronouncement in a bill doesn't make it into a statute doesn't give any weight to the argument that the opposite should occur, does it?
I think that what we have to remember is what was in existence prior to the legislative session 2003, and that was this court's rule promulgated in 1999 that allowed 202 depositions, including 202 depositions in medical malpractice cases. The legislature was clearly aware of that. And in the first bill, they said, all right, we're going to prohibit, and then we're going to allow restricted ones. And then in the end result, they came full circle, withdrew everything, and left it as it were it was
well,
on January 1st.
Not strictly. I mean, they also expanded the permissible scope of written discovery as well, mm-hmm. because the House bill, the original House bill version, only allowed the medical records and tangible right. things. And so they considered 202. Then when they decided not to put 202 in, they expanded the type of written discovery that is permissible. They included interrogatories, depositions on written questions that had not been in the original version. As they took away one, I have a difficult time reading anything into the legislative intent here. You can argue it round or square.
Well, here's the interesting thing. Remember, Government Code Section 22.004 says that your rules remain in effect unless and until modified by the legislature. 74.351S does not modify any rule of procedure at all. It says you can only use these rules of procedure and rules of discovery prior to the expert report. To say that Rule 202 cannot be taken ever in a medical malpractice investigation would be clearly a modification of Rule 202 that was promulgated by this court under 202 and would necessarily have to be done pursuant to and in compliance with Section 22.004 of the Government Code. It is telling, and it's very, very important to note, that in the first two versions of the House bill in the House, they specifically invoked Rule 22.004 of the Government Code, but then when they pulled out the provisions of prohibition or restricting 202, they also pulled out the reference in the invocation of Section 22.004 of the Government Code.
But they did, as opposing counsel points out in 002, say this chapter controls, including over rules of procedure. It is true, we frequently say, well, they didn't mean to mess with our procedures. But we don't usually say that when they say, yes, we do mean to mess with your procedures, because that gets us in a fight with the people that fund us.
That provision only applies, however, if there is a conflict between the statute and the rule. And we should always remember that the purpose and goal here is to construe statutes such as to avoid a conflict, if that can be done. And Justice Worthen, in the Allen opinion, did exactly that. He pointed out that Chapter 74 applies to a health care liability claim, and this is not a health care liability claim under 202.
Let me ask you real quickly. If we disagreed on your construction about potential health care liability claim versus health care liability claim, do you lose?
Yes. Importantly, my client will never know.
Well, my understanding of the way the posture is now, you could go back and you could take depositions on written questions.
I don't see how, where in Chapter 74...
Well, your opposing counsel's conceded that to that extent the two don't conflict. To that extent, you could take depositions on written questions.
Well, I would submit that either 202 is allowed or 202 is not allowed. To sit here now at this point in time, 4 or 5 years after the legislature passed, to say, okay, we're going to allow some 202 in the form of written questions and maybe some interrogatories, but not 202. I don't see where that is in the statute or the legislative history.
The argument would be you have to harmonize them when you can, and that would be a way to harmonize them.
It may also be harmonized by determining that there is no conflict between Chapter 74 and Rule 202. And I would point out to the Court that while 202 may be ancillary and incident to an anticipated suit, it is not itself an independent suit, as this Court said in 1965. And that is because for three reasons. Number one, Rule 202 petition does not assert any claim or cause of action. 202 depositions may never lead to a suit because the facts learned may determine that there is no merit. Number three, 202 petitions cannot result in obtaining any relief or recovery whatsoever. If granted, a 202 petition simply allows you to discover facts. And I would point out that there are a number of federal cases that have reached the same conclusion. Page versus Liberty, and these are all 2006 U.S. District Lexis citations, 73745, Sawyer, Lexis 44026, Davidson 40654, Mayfield and George 16338. And while I'm touching on the topic of the federal courts, I'm wondering that if you cannot discover facts to determine if you have a lawsuit, and therefore you are deprived of your ability to bring a suit.
I hear you say that, but that sounds good, but I still haven't heard why depositions and written questions wouldn't work. I mean, oral depositions would be better. Yeah. I know that you'd like them more, but I haven't seen concretely yet in this case why depositions on written questions would not. You know, to me, if you took the depositions on written questions and then it didn't give you the information you need, then you could rely on the provision of House Bill 4 that says, you know, this can't unduly restrict in a manner that's going to kill a claim. But it seems to me these statutes set up a structure that are difficult and they're barriers. But I keep hearing from you that if you can't take everything, you can't do anything.
What? Another way to look at this is that if the legislature had intended that we could only take 202 depositions by written question, I think that they would have done so. Just as in the second version, where they said we could take a 202 deposition if records weren't provided or the facts were not sufficient in the records to make a determination. But the reality is the legislature didn't do the prohibition in the first phase, didn't do the restricted at all, and didn't add in a section that said, okay, we're going to allow 202, but only by written question. And so I think we're left here to look at the legislative history and the plain language of the statute, as Justice Hanks and the N. Ray Hogg pointed out.
Counselor, your time has expired. Are there any other questions? Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
Very briefly, counsel said Rule 202 depositions either are allowed or not allowed. You know, one of the reasons that the 202 language or prohibition may have been taken out of the statute was because of the interpretation we're urging here, and that is certain 202 depositions are being allowed, that is written depositions, but others are not being allowed, consistent with Section 74.351S. Now, counsel...
Of course, the reason people don't do depos on written questions is because the opposing side's lawyer writes the answers. And I'm concerned you've got a firm 120-day deadline here, 180-day. 120 days. So you agree that under you, they could take this deposition after the case was filed?
We believe that under you, consistent with... N. Ray Miller.
That's right. You think that's only non-parties.
Non-parties, correct.
But assuming some court construed it, since it doesn't say that, that it applied to parties, that would not be much help if the defendant doctor's attorney stalled the deposition until the 119th day.
Well, obviously, there's provisions to go to the courts to seek orders from the trial court requiring the deponents to be...
All of which takes time. I mean, you know, you don't have to answer for 20 days plus Monday and...
Correct.
Et cetera.
Correct. But, again, counsel...
There will be cases where you just can't tell from the records.
Well, I don't know. And I'm not so sure this is one of those cases because counsel, what he said earlier was, what did Dr. Jordan tell Tyler Cardiovascular Consultants about when she should come or vice versa? Now, first off, generally if there's written orders about appearing, that would be in the medical records. But certainly, why wouldn't written depositions to Tyler Cardiovascular Consultants or to Dr. Jordan reveal what was said to each other regarding when Ms. Allen should appear for her stress test? I mean, that seems to me to be clearly the type of information that could be obtained from written questions. What was said generally is recorded in most medical records, is recorded when there's a referral. This doesn't seem to me to be the type of case where you would need oral depositions in order to find out this information.
But you're not saying that your lawyer can't take his own client's deposition before she dies.
Well, what I'm saying is there are ways around that.
Such as?
First off, if he is concerned about his client passing away, there is obviously under Rule 74-351S, limitations on what you can do before your expert report is filed. If you're concerned about your client passing away, you can immediately file your expert report. Get that information together prior to the time you file your lawsuit. You file your expert report with your lawsuit, which is done in many occasions, and immediately notice your client for the deposition and take the deposition. Other thing that's done that we see all the time is where you do these day-in-the-life videos about what the plaintiff's life was like when that person is not there to testify. We have those presented, and there are cases that are out there which have allowed the admissions of those types of evidence in order to show what the plaintiff was like prior to the time he or she expired. I'm sorry, Justice Johnson.
Why would we allow written depositions and not oral depositions? They are really not very satisfactory.
Well, I assume that even though the parties are under oath, somehow they're not going to tell the truth. Well, if they're not very satisfactory, why do we have interrogatories?
They're not going to tell the truth. It's they may not even answer the question. And that's what an oral deposition is. You ask the question and they dodge it. You ask the question, they dodge it, and finally you get an answer. And in written depositions, you just don't have those opportunities. So why is a written deposition and not an oral deposition when you're having to find out some fairly intricate, probably dispositive facts, and someone's not going to want to give you that information?
Well, two things, Justice Johnson. First off, I believe that if the party does not answer or the deponent doesn't answer, there are procedures to go back to the trial court and compel them to answer.
Push it on down the road with more time and more time and more time. That's what happens.
That may be the case. But there are procedures to compel an answer under oath. And I guess the other issue is if interrogatories and if written depositions are such useless means of discovery, then why do we still have them in the rules of civil procedure?
How many times are they used on a party, where you're really trying to cross-examine someone as a practical matter?
Well, obviously here we're just trying to find out limited information. We're not trying to do a full-blown deposition. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All right.